The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Roots of Ashkenazic Jewry, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Rabbi Chanan ben Yamin, Mr. Hugo Apt, Olav HaShalom, of blessed memory.
After the decline of Babylon, the spiritual center of Jewry, two major centers emerged to take its place. One in the extended Jewish community of Tsarfas and Ashkenaz, France and Germany, and the other Sfarad and Afriki, Spain and North African coast. These two places spawned what we call today Ashkenazic, means German and Eastern European Jewry, and Sephardic, which is commonly referred to the name, to North African and Middle Eastern Jewry. Even though these two areas emerged after the death of Rav Haigon in the year 1038 to take the place of Pumpadisa and Sura, the great yeshivas of Babylon, these areas, Germany, France, Spain, had already become places of Torah at least 200 years before. The subject of this lecture is the development of Ashkenazic Jewry and Torah scholarship during the last 200 years of the Gaonic era. The next lecture will be devoted to the roots of Sephardic Jewry. Although we now look at Italy as a distinct and minor center of Torah scholarship, the truth is that Ashkenazic Jewry traces its roots to Italy, and it's from Italy that we'll begin tonight's lecture. On the first page of your notes, in paragraph A, we quote from a Gemara in Brachos, New Testament Aleph 19a, about a correspondence that was made from Shimon ben Shetach to Todos, Thaddeus, a leader of the Jewish community of Rome. This is approximately 70 years before the Common Era. Through Todos, the Romans had begun a custom to, in a sense, to have a connection to what was happening in Yerushalayim. They didn't actually sacrifice a Paschal lamb, but they took a normative lamb, a non-sacred lamb, slaughtered it, and roasted it whole, just like one would do a Paschal lamb, as a zecher, as a remembrance of what was, even though they were so far from Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash temple standing then, but they should have a connection. Shimon ben Shetach, who was the leader of Jewry then, wrote to him, and he says, if you were not Thaddeus, if you weren't a person of that stature, I would pronounce the sentence of excommunication on you, because you're making Jews at least appear to eat holy things outside their designated area, outside Yerushalayim. The Gemara in Psachim, it wonders what kind of a man was this Thaddeus, Tudus, who was he? And it goes on to explain, this is the bottom of the page, that not only was he a scholar, you could look yourself at the reference, but also it says, from a historical point, it's very important. Yossi Barovin said he was Mata Malay Lakis Talmid Chachomi, cast merchandise into the pockets of scholars. In other words, he was a man who supported scholars by giving them merchandise that they themselves could go on to sell, in other words, to set these people up in business. It was an act of charity, but it wasn't charity. In other words, he set them up. He, as a partner, got a percentage of the profits, but gave the dignity to these people and enabled them in an easy way to continue their learning. If that's the case, then we know in the year 70 before the Common Era in Rome, not only was there a person of scholarship himself, but a person who supported other scholars. And evidently then, Rome was a place of scholarship. This is in the year, there's a difference, of course, if one would send monies, okay, then one understands. Maybe sent monies to scholars in Israel. But the expression he gave merchandise evidently indicates that the people he was dealing with were at hand, which indicated Italy was a place, Rome and Italy were a place of scholarship even then. On page 2, we briefly refer to a decree that was issued in the reign of the Emperor Tiberius. This is he reigned between the years 14 and 37, the Common Era, to expel both Egyptians and Jews. The purported reason was that the Jews were really a menace because they were proselytizing. Many non-Jews were becoming Jews during that period. It seems, though, that this forced migration of Jews from Rome or Italy was short-lived. But it does indicate the strength of numbers and the influence that Jews had during the time. We now push ahead, so to speak. We know, besides the community of Rome that existed at least from the year 70 before the Common Era, in all probability, if you have a community that has scholars, it's a community that's been well established. But we have, after the destruction of the temple in the year 70 of the Common Era, this is like some 140 years after two deceased Romans, there was an influx of Jews. These were the captives from Jerusalem. One of those captives is referred to, this is in paragraph C on page 2, is Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, one of the leaders of Jewry, in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple, went to Rome to try to redeem the captives. One of the captives that he discovered was a young boy who eventually became the famous Rabbi Shmo ben Elisha, the colleague of Rabbi Akiva. So this was in the aftermath of the year 70, so one doesn't know the exact year 71, 72, of the Common Era, but here already we find at least the presence of many Jews, an influx of Jews. And probably, in all probability, those who were redeemed stayed. 100 years, some 90 years after that, because again, what we find historically is very fragmentary, but it gives you a sense of the community. We find that Rome is one of the leading Torah centers of the world. And here in paragraph D, we find that the Chazal says the Talmud commenting on the verse, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, says you should follow justice, interprets that you should follow the scholars to their academies. If you want to know the truth on the Torah, the truth of the Torah, you should go to the greatest scholars and seek the truth. And it enumerates the greatest scholars and their yeshivas. One of them who are enumerated, and this is in bold type, is Rav Masya of Rome. If you want to know the true Torah, go to Rome to study by Rav Masya. And again, just an indication, this is approximately the year 160 of the Common Era, but it gives you an indication of what Rome was. Generally, in order to start a yeshiva, you need talmidim, you need a source where to draw students. Many places, and this is the history of America, many great scholars landed up into small cities in the East Coast and the Midwest, but they didn't have congregants. They didn't have students. And their scholarship and all their learning, and this is left no great mark, you know, on the generation that came after them. The fact is that there was a yeshiva on the highest level in Rome is an indication of what the community of Rome was. Finally, and this is the last citation here of Rome in Talmudic times. We know, and this is we've discussed this in the previous lecture, the Roman authorities were bent upon destroying the office of the patriarch, the Nossi, that descendant of Hillel, who was the nominal head of Jewry, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. We know already in the 5th century, at least in the beginnings of the 5th century, the office of patriarch still existed. It was eventually abolished by the Romans. But here in the citation, here, this is on the bottom of page 2, this is a decree of Honorius, who was the Roman emperor. At the time of Honorius, actually there were two Roman emperors. Honorius was the Western Roman emperor of Rome, France, Italy. His brother Arcadius was the whose capital was in Byzantium, Constantinople, was the who was the emperor over the East, as Eretz Yisrael, Syria, etc. Honorius evidently issued a decree then to the Western Empire, which was focused in Rome. And here he issued a decree that the synagogues were no longer allowed to collect monies and send it to Eretz Yisrael, to Israel, to support the patriarch, the Nossi. This is the year 399, which is indicative of the close relations that they had. This, again, we don't know. It's all very fragmentary. At this point, we don't know about scholarship in Rome. We don't know how many Jews there are in Rome or in the environs. But one thing we know is they supported Eretz Yisrael, and they supported the Nossi. And they had enough influence that after that decree, which was in 399, 5 years later, there was another decree made by Honorius. We can read this on page 3. We commanded that the funds, which according to the customs of these lands were exacted by the Jewish patriarchs, should no longer be exacted. But now we remove the first law. As he issued on not to do it, we're removing that now. And we wish all to be aware of the Jewish privilege granted them by our indulgence, we establish according to the old formula to send their funds away. Evidently they bribed, took them 5 years, enough bribes to change the law. But they reinstated it. This is in the year 404, but already by the year 430 or so, it had already been banished. The whole office of patriarch had been destroyed. And the monies again, they were commanded not to, the monies were not to be sent to Eretz Yisrael. But it gives you a sense, at least in Rome or in that whole area, there was a strong connection to support Torah. I mean, that way. I mean, where you give the monies, they were sent to the, you know, it was the nominal head of the Sanhedrin. It was really to support the Jewish community, and in all probability would be the Torah institutions in Eretz Yisrael. It was very difficult for Jews in Rome or in the whole Roman Empire. Here we discussed right now about the law barring them, the question about to support Israel. There are other laws that were made, and just we've touched this in the previous lecture, just touch this again, just to give you an indication of what life was, at least under the Romans. During that period of time, slaves were the primary source of cheap and competitive labor. In other words, if I had a slave, and as it would be worth my while, make the investment of slaves, just to keep my overhead low. If I would have to hire workers, I would really raise my overhead and be less competitive. Jews, really since the advent of Christianity, became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and this from the beginning of Constantine, Jews were not allowed to own Christian slaves. And even after the Roman Empire collapsed, the original laws that existed on the books in the by the Roman emperors remained the law in Italy and France and all those areas that had once had become had been at one time part of that Roman Empire. So even throughout all these centuries, even after there were no more Roman emperors, Jews still were not allowed to own Christian slaves. Just to give you just a little a taste of what it was. This is from the Code of Theodosius, from the year 415. Quote, if any Jew keeps Christian slaves, the slaves are to be freed and placed in the custody of the church according to the laws of Constantine. And later on, so in the year 423, again prohibiting them to own Christian slaves, the Jews who are authors of such great crimes shall be punished with capital punishment and also loss of their property. And of course, as Christianity became the state religion, it was very hard to find a non-Christian slave. And this was reiterated again in the year 5, this is in Justinian in 534, no pagan Jew or non-Orthodox person. There's non-Orthodox, assuming about a heretic, in other words, may own a Christian slave. Besides economic difficulties that were placed in their ways, there were spiritual difficulties as well. The Jews were not allowed to erect any new synagogues. And again, this is from the Code of Theodosius. And this was issued in the year 423. Moreover, no further synagogues are to be constructed. The old ones are to remain in their present state of repair. It took an awful lot of bribes to change anything. And it was just very, very difficult. Yet despite all of this, and we're going to see is that the Torah and Jewry flourished in Italy and Germany and all those areas that were once part of the former Roman Empire. We've discussed Rome. There were other centers of Torah. On page 3, we discuss Bari. Bari was a city on the eastern coast, on the Adriatic coast of Italy. Rabbeinu Tam, this is in the 12th century, refers to that community of Bari. This is a city, we say Kimitzian Tetzetera, the common saying was, for from Bari, Kimi Bari Tetzet Torah. It was such a great Torah center. Dvar Hashem and the Word of God from Otrantis, which was another neighboring city. You know, probably in Eastern Europe, three-quarters of a century ago, they would have said from Volozhin, from Slobodka, you know, from Pressburg, those were the centers of Torah. Bari, Otrantis. In another response, Rabbeinu Tam refers to them as citing their rulings as authoritative. Referring to Rabbeinu Gershon, followed the ruling of Rabbeinu Hai, referring to a specific area in Halacha, as did our rabbis in Bari and in Lothar. This was Lorraine, this in Worms, Mayence, Speyer. Rashi, who was one of them, who lived in Lothar, also ruled such. But the rabbis in Bari were cited as an authoritative source. Evidently, it was a great place of scholarship. We know of Rome, of course, as a place of scholarship we quoted before in Talmudic times. But at the time of the end of the Gaonim, again, this is in the year 1038, the death of Rav Hai, we place this the end of that period. But during that period, it seems that Rome was a flourishing center of Torah. This is taken from a responsa here on paragraph G of page 3 from Rashi. Rishonim says it's Rashi asked the question from Rabbona Marona Rav Nosson Gaon, who authored the Oroch. Let's say this is in the year 1190. So he asked this question to Rav Nosson and Mar Daniel, his brother, and Mar Avram, his brother. There were three brothers who were scholars the great Rashi sought direction from. This is in Rome. They answered him. This question was already asked in the yeshiva of Mar Yechiel Gon, their father. This has been the generation before. And he answered the name of Mar Yaakov Gon, Reish Masifta of the city of Rome, the head of the yeshiva, which would place the Mar Yaakov Gon, really a contemporary of High Gon. In other words, they gave him the title Gaon simply because he was not of the Babylonian Gaonim, but it was an honorific title as the Rosh Yeshiva. But this was, we find this Mar Yaakov Gon, the Reish Masifta, the city of Rome, a flourishing yeshiva at the time of the end of the Gaonim. Rashi himself, that yeshiva continued on even afterwards, where Rashi quotes, this is particularly, this is taken from a response of Rashi. Rashi also quotes this in his commentary in the Talmud and in the Gemara and Be'ah. He says, even today I received a letter from Worms that say that Reb Clonimus, a great man of advanced years, who studied in the yeshiva of Rome and who's an expert in the entire Talmud, ruled similarly. This is referring to that Rashi quotes support of Rashi's own decision through a decision, a similar decision made by Rav Clonimus. But again, how he's described, a man who is a Boki B'chol HaTalmud, an expert in the entire Talmud, and who studied in the yeshiva of Rome. So during this time, Rome, we find at the end of the period of the Gaonim and the beginning of the period of Rishonim, was a major Torah center. As we will see throughout this lecture, unlike the Babylonian sages, with the exception of Sadia Gaon, who originally did not come from Babylon, the Rosh Yeshivas in Babylon were Talmudic scholars. They're not known for other great contributions in other areas outside Talmudic study. Rav Sadia Gaon, which was a subject of a previous lecture, of course, was a multifaceted scholar. The Rosh Yeshivas in Italy, besides being Rosh Yeshivas and as experts in the Talmud, were often talented, this is Paitonim, religious poets, and composed many brilliant poetic works. In fact, their compositions are still being said over 1,000 years later. On paragraph 8, on H, on the bottom of page 3, paragraph H, we quote a piyut of Rav Shvatia. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Av Beis Din, the head of a rabbinical court in Oria, in southern Italy, in the 800s, I mean, in the 9th century. And here we have, says this is a, those who say Slichas is familiar, Yisrael Moshe Ba'ashem Teshua Seilomim Gam Hayom Yevoshu Simapicho Shoichen Meroimim Kiata Rav Slichoi Suval Harachamim. And it goes on to continue every stanza after that first one, spells out the next one, Shorecha Heim Doifkim. It spells out Shin, then Pei, then Tes, then Yud, then Hei. Shvatia, spelling out his name, which was the literary device that poets used then to indicate their name. At that time, you know, in the 9th century, Oria and many other communities in southern Italy were part of the Byzantine Empire. Because even though the old Roman Empire had broken up, the Byzantine Empire, whose capital was in Constantinople, tried to spread out. They were not able to have all of Italy, but in the 9th century, they had domination over southern Italy. A fascinating story is told about Rav Shvatia by a descendant of his, also Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Achimoetz ben Paltiel. And the story, as the story goes, this is approximately the year 873. The Byzantine emperor then was Basil the First, and he issued a decree that all the Jews of his realm either convert or be put to death. which was, this is a very familiar in Jewish history, a very familiar theme, unfortunately. Rushfatia traveled to Constantinople to try to intercede with the emperor. Upon arriving in Constantinople, Rushfatia found that the emperor, Basil's daughter, was deathly ill. According to the story of his descendant, Rav Achimoetz, Rushfatia was able to effect a miraculous cure, and as a reward, he asked that the decree be annulled. The emperor partially granted his request and released the Jews of Oria as well as four other Jewish communities from his decree. We've just quoted, this is one of the many, this is Piyutim of Rushfatia. On page 4 on the top, we quote a piyut of Rushfatia's son and successor in the yeshiva and the Besdin in Oria, Rav Amitai. And again, this is taken, for this is very famous. The Hashem Hashem is said on the fifth day of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. It begins with the 13 attributes of mercy, and the next stanza begins with Aleph Eskro Elokim Ve'amoya Beroisikol Ir Al Tila Benuya of Ir Elokim Mushpeles At Sheol Tachdia. Says I remember. Says that I. With great emotion, says, I see that every city is built, but the city of Hashem, God's city, Yerushalayim, is lowered until the depths. Behold, Zayson, despite this, all our suffering, Onu Luko Veneinu Luko, we belong to God, says, we have allegiance to God, and our eyes look forward to God's salvation. And this is the Aleph, and it goes on to spell out Amitai. This is the first letter of every stanza. Who was the author of this and many other poetic works. Up until now I've given you like a brief idea of what was Italian Jewry. I'd like to now give you another, we're going to put them both together, to give you another view now of Ashkenazic Jewry, of German Jewry. The first reference we have to Jews in Germany, well, technically today we don't call them such. In those days we will see it was all really one part of one Jewry. They went later on to go their separate ways. We're going to discuss that. But as stands now, really Italy, as we're going to see, Germany, were all really a continuation of one long, you know, one large part of Jewry. It would be akin, that... would say that, you know, in Ashkenazic Jewry, when its beginnings in the 14th century, it was situated in Germany, and that's how it looked. As it kept on spreading to Lithuania and Poland and Hungary, it took on a different complexion. So the Lithuanian Jews, even though they're descendants of these original German Jews, there are significant differences between them, you know, the non-Hasidic Lithuanian Jews and Hasidic Polish Jews. So there are historic changes that have taken place, but their roots are one. In that sense, the roots of Italian Jewry, as we're going to point out, and German Jewry have much in common. Later on, they branched out. But again, the series is the period of the Gaonim, and we're dealing with the early stages. In those early stages, they're actually one extended community. The first reference to Ashkenazic Jewry we find in the decree of Constantine the First. And here he issued to the rabbis, heads of the community, wardens, and others serving in the synagogues of the city of Cologne were exempt from certain state obligations. He reiterated their rights, but evidently the city of Cologne was singled out. Evidently, it was a large community of Jews. This, by the way, we don't hear of Cologne for many years afterwards. There's a reference, it's a controversial reference, there's a reference It's at the end of the Sefer, which we're going to refer to next in the next lecture as well. In the end of the prophecy, says of the prophet Ovadia. And he refers to the captivity of those who are in the exile returning back to Eretz Yisrael at the end of the days. And he enumerates as the places where they are today, or where the prophet, and where they will now eventually go back home. And he refers to the Jews of Tsarfas, Tsarfas referring to France, and Svarad referring to Spain. There's also a reference to the Canaanim. And this is how it says, "Begolas hechel hazel levnei Yisrael," the captivity of the host of the children of Israel, "asher Canaanim ad Tsarfas." So the Radak explains, which are in the land of the Canaanim up until Tsarfas, up until, according to the Radak, France, and also the Jews that are in Svarad, which he translates Spain. These two centers of Jewry will go back home, go back to Israel. And he refers to the land of Canaanim as the land of Germany. That's how he interprets this. And he explains that and I will quote you from his commentary, "For when the Canaanites left their lands because of Yeshua, as written in our commentary in the book of Yeshua, they went to the lands of Alemannia and Cologne," Alemannia is southern Germany, and Cologne, what is now called Ashkenaz. "To this day, the natives are called Canaanites." The fact is, which is indisputable, that in medieval times, the Germans of that area were called Canaanim. The Radak, David Kimchi, in the 13th century, offers explanation. They're called Canaanim because that's where the Canaanites went to settle. And eventually Jews went there, but according to Radak, Jews went there in the time of Titus, was at the time of destruction of the temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. So this was a prophecy, according to his explanation, is that Ovadia the prophet, who lived in the time of the first Beis Hamikdash, he lived in the time of the year 700 before the Common Era, or 800 before the Common Era, is seeing the future, and is saying that eventually Jews will be exiled some 800 years, 900 years from now, to the land of the Canaanim, land of Tsarfas, the land of Svarad, and they will eventually come back home to Eretz Yisrael.
Isn't Germany?
Yeah, right.
Germany,
yeah, but this is how they it's in those things that this was they looked at a specific part of Germany then. It was southern Germany. Of course, not everyone understands, even though it's true that it was called in that time the land of Canaanim, not everyone agrees that it was called that because that's where the Canaanim of the time of Yeshua went to be resettled. In fact, this is according to Professor Max Weinreich of the City College of New York, who is an expert not only in the history of the Yiddish language, but also of the early history of Jewry. And in his work, the work of the history of the Yiddish language, he explains that the northern half of the Balkan Peninsula, Eastern Europe, and the eastern part of Central Europe beyond the Elbe and Saale rivers, which extended south to the Bamberg and Nuremberg, was originally occupied by the Slavs and was called by Greek and Roman writers not by what you would expect it to be called, Slavinia, the land of Slavs, but rather the Greeks and the Romans called it sklavinia, or esklavonia, which literally means the land of the slaves. Sklavus means slave in Latin. And the reason that they called it slave land, was not Slav land, because the Slavs were exported from these lands by way of the Byzantine territories who sold the slaves to the Muslim countries. Since the land was called slave land in Latin, the Jews called it Canaan, which is a name which is synonymous with slavery, as we read in the Torah in Parshas Noach, Canaan Eved Avodim Yus Lechov, Canaan will be a slave of slaves to his brethren. So the fact is, it was called the land of Canaan, is not because, let's say, the Canaanites, the original Canaanites, time Yeshua ben Nun resettled there, but rather it was a way of just calling it, this was slave land because it was occupied by the Slavs who were sold as slaves, or plundered and sold as slaves. You know, much as the Africans, you know, in the 18th century, in Western Africa, they were exploited and then, you know, they were kidnapped and sold as slaves. That's what occurred to the Slavs. So according to this, it's really called the land of Canaan simply because of the history, because it was actually the place of the Slavs. I have in fact, in the Hebrew language today, it says Yiddish is called Canaanit. And my mother-in-law, Shalom, she went to, you know, there's a document when she came to Eretz Yisrael that says, which language does she speak? And this is all in Ivrit. Since she spoke Yiddish, it's Canaanit. Because that's a land of Canaan, because Canaan was known as that whole area. It was referred to as Canaan. According to the Barbanel then, which would follow this, that the word Canaan in this passage does not mean the land of the Canaanites, because that was just a popular expression, but it's a expression that the exile of the Jewish people who went like the Canaanites, it was just like the Canaanim were exiled and were displaced. So the Jews, Avadia's foretelling, because Avadia lived in the time when Jews were well settled in Israel. And he foretold, though, just like the Canaanim, which you know in your past history, were exiled, so too you Jews will be exiled like the Canaanim, will be forced to leave the land, and you will go, not necessarily like the Canaanim went, but you will go all the way to Tsarfas, which he explains to be France, and as well as to Svorad and to Spain. Except for the recording of the expulsion of Jews from central France in the year 629, history is largely silent about French and German Jewry between Constantine's decree, which we quoted in 331, and the reign of Charlemagne in approximately the year 800. It has been suggested that after withdrawal of Roman forces from the Rhine River due to pressure of the Germanic tribes, which happened sometime after the period of Constantine, the Jewish population of that area, which included Cologne, dwindled because they had tremendous pressure from the barbarians. It was only really up until the Rhine River, which had been Latinized, which was under Roman control and was influenced by Roman culture. Beyond the Rhine, the Germans there were pagans. And we're barbarians. And once basically it's like the police would leave the inner city. And the Jews, which has been the lot of Jews throughout history, moved to a safer neighborhood. And it seems that they moved westerly to central France. Sometime between the year 797 and 806, and according to this Max Weinreich, it was in the year 801, Charlemagne sent a delegation to the Caliph Harun ibn Rashid in Baghdad, which was the subject of previous lecture. Amongst his delegation was a Jew who lived in Aachen, Charlemagne's capital. His name was Isaac Yitzchak. And he is recorded, he was one of those who were sent to the caliph in Baghdad. Approximately in the year 820, the Jewish merchants are mentioned in Aachen, as we see from the following quotes taken from Dian Grunfeld's book. They were quite influential. As you see, this is on page 4, in the first quarter of the 9th century, the Jews of the Carolingian Empire, in other words, this is under Charlemagne, were so powerful they forced the rulers of that empire to adopt a favorable policy towards them. And they had autonomy, and they were even if they were forced to go in a non-Jewish court, but the proceedings had to be based upon the rules of Talmudic law. So Jews were not subject to trial by ordeal or trial by combat, which was common by the barbarians of that time. This is taken from Agis's Heroic Age of Franco-German Jewry. But by the middle of the 8th century, because all we have to reconstruct this history are fragments, but we have a sense of what these people were like. This is on page 4, paragraph C, it says, in all of Spain and all the communities of Ashkenaz, this is Rav Amram going writes, this is in the middle of the 9th century, may they remember favorable blessing 1,000 times over for those Jews of Ashkenaz and Spain are full of Torah and mitzvahs like a pomegranate. Their actions are beautiful. They are stringent in checking for treifas and the ritual immersion and all that is fit to be stringent. So evidently we have a community, not just Jews in name, but very pious Jews. And again, this is in the bottom of page 4, on the beginning of page 5, we quote a responsa. A question was sent from the Jews of the Rhine, the Jews of Worms, is in the 10th century to the yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael. Again, these fragments at least give us a sense of a community. A little bit here, a little bit there. In the sense, there were Jews in Germany, Jews who were very pious, Jews who were asking questions. But we also know that the paths of these two communities merged. This is German Jewry and Italian Jewry were connected. One is, this is a story that we quoted last lecture, we're going to quote in the next lecture, just briefly touch upon this. This is in paragraph A. This is about the four scholars who traveled by boat, left the city of Bari, which again we discussed was a place of Torah. They left for the according to this account, which is from the Sefer HaKabbalah of the Ravid, they left for Hachnosas Kala, which has been ultimately explained to go to a wedding or to collect funds for the Kala in the Yeshiva in Babylon. But they were traveling from Italy. They were captured by pirates and they were resold. These scholars did not, on page 6, did not reveal their identity. Therefore, when they were sold just for a nominal amount, and therefore the Jewish community was able to redeem them at a reasonable rate. But the admiral sold Rav Shemaria in the second paragraph on page 6. Rav Shemaria in Alexandria in Egypt. From there he went to the capital of Egypt in Fustat and became Rosh Yeshiva because they were all great scholars. The admiral of this fleet of pirates sold Rav Hushiel in Africa. Then there's Tunisia, which is the seashore. From there he went up to El Kairouan, which was a major center of Jewry then. It was the most vibrant of the western states under Arabic control. There Rav Hushiel became the Rosh Yeshiva. There his wife gave birth to Rabbeinu Hananel, his son. Rabbeinu Hananel became the famous Rosh Yeshiva in the next generation in North Africa. The admirals came to Cordova in Spain, so the Rav Moshe of Chanoch, his son. The people of Cordova redeemed him, thinking them to be unlettered, and eventually he also, Rav Moshe, became the Rosh Yeshiva in Cordova, and after his death, Rav Chanoch became his successor. From this event, the Ravid traces the rise of the great Torah institutions in these places, in Egypt, in North Africa, and in Spain. But this is all from Italy. So the influence of Italian Jewry was really felt far and wide. the Rashbam, just quotes on page 6, refers to Rabbeinu Hananel, who was really born in North Africa, as Ish Romi, you know, the man of Rome, the citizen of Rome, because of his Roman roots. But Italian scholarship not only spread out to the Sephardic lands, but closer to home, spread out to Germany. And here we find the quote on page 6. This is a reference to really three generations of scholars who came from Lucca. This is Rabbi Meshulam the Great, the son of Rabbeinu Kalonymus. This is quoted from the Marshal, this is the Shlomo Luria, in one of his responses, in Simchat Tes, in response to 29, where he quotes sources to trace the early history of Ashkenazic Jewry. And he says that Rabbeinu Meshulam the Great was the son of Rabbeinu Kalonymus, who was the son of Rav Moshe the Elder. And he goes on to say Rabbeinu Moshe is the one who composed Amos Neresecha, which is a Piyut, a poem which is customary to read in many congregations the last day of Pesach. He is the Rabbi Moshe the Elder, who is the son, he quotes his whole Yichus, Rabbeinu Kalonymus, the son of Rabbi Kusil, the son of Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbi Meshulam, these Atiel, the son of Rabbeinu Meshulam. These names keep on going back. And it would seem that it's a long line of rabbis, long line of scholars. Rabbeinu Moshe, that was brought from Lucca by King Charles. The King Charles that would have been in that year would be King Charles the Simple. The Simple means not stupid, but pure. It was like the Yaakovish term. To be with him in Germany, this was in the year 918. This is the he is the one, Ramosha the Elder, right, who is in the second sentence over here, and he came in the year 918, and then he has a long list of rabbis he's descended from, and evidently these are, as we explained, Italy was a great Torah center. Lucca, though, was a place in northern Italy, as we spoke about Bari, Otrantis, Oria, which was in southern Italy. This is in northern Italy. Everything comes with a great history. We quote on page 7 just a little this Amos Neresecha from the art scroll. From the art scroll, Machzor on Pesach has this. It is taken from the eighth day, and it spells out, you know, this was the method, Clonimos, which was the family. Again, this name Clonimos keeps on coming up, and it was the Clonimos family. This Rav Meshulam, which we're going to quote again, the grandson of this Rav Moshe, was a contemporary of Rav Shmiragon, and in the Gaonica, this was the tshuvas of the Gaonim which were recovered in the Cairo Geniza. The following are the questions, just to show the preface of Rabbi Meshulam, the son of Rav Clonimus of the city of Lucca, which is in France. This is part of, which is then included northern Italy. Evidently, France, just as it was one long area, which included part of Italy. So, as you show the Italian Ashkenazic connection. Opposed to Rabbeinu Shmiragon, so the question of high Gon was Av Beis Din, and this was somewhere between 986 and 104, he posed this question. But he was a contemporary and wrote to them for advice. And he had a tremendous influence as Rabbeinu Meshulam, was of Lucca, as we find that the Beis Din of, in paragraph D on page 7, the Beis Din of Arles, which is in province, southern France, and again, says, he sent to Narbonne, they looked to him as their mentor. So there was a connection of southern France and northern Italy. Rashi quotes him. This is in the bottom of page 7. But Rav Shulam Bar Kalonimus Gaon said at the time of his death. And Rabbeinu Gershom quotes him as a source of, you know, the controversy which we've discussed in the previous lecture about saying piyutim, about saying these religious poems, but in the middle of the recitation of the Shemoneh Esrei. You know, this question of, you know, how do you interrupt the Shemoneh Esrei with saying these poems? And he points to so many great people before his time who have followed that practice of saying these poems. He quotes, of course, Elazar of Rabbi Kalir, which we spent much time on. Also, Rabbeinu Clonimus ben Moshe of Lucca was a great sage and composed Krovos. These are the prayers of the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. For all the holidays, he also mentioned Agoda. Many subjects included this in the poems. And we know that Rabbi Meshulam of Lucca, his son, was a great scholar and posed a Krova for the fast of Yom Kippur. In the middle of the bracha, he articulated many different topics. At the end, at the close of the bracha, he mentioned themes in concert with the bracha. But again, he cites Rabbeinu Clonimus and Rabbi Meshulam of Italy as sources to rely upon for saying, you know, these poems. We see they were, again, this is part of the tradition of Italian Jewry, that one of their great scholars are also poets. But also Rabbeinu Gershom, who was the greatest, you know, of the generation at the close of the Gaonic era, as he died, Rav Chai Gaon died in the year 1038, so Rabbeinu Gershom died in the year 1040. So he was the greatest in Germany during that period at the close of the Gaonic era, but he quotes this Rabbeinu Meshulam. So again, just to give you a sense of the influence that Italian Jewry scholars had over Ashkenazic Jewry. I'd like to focus on some of the great scholars in the time we have who lived at the time. Again, this is at the end of the Gaonic era, at the time of Rabbeinu Gershom. One of his contemporaries was Rav Shimon HaGadol. Again, says the Marshal, says Rav Shlomo Luria, gives a list of the great people during this time, which was at the close of the Gaonic era. Rav Eliezer HaGadol, Rav Shimon HaGadol from Mayence, this was in the Rhine Valley, Rav Shlomo HaBavli, we're going to see who this is, Rabbeinu Meshulam, which we quoted before, Rabbeinu Clonimus, his father. From these did Rabbeinu Gershon of Metz receive Torah knowledge. This Rabbeinu Shimon HaGadol was a very unusual person. Again, in that response on top of page 9, we find Rabbi Shimon HaGadol, this is Marshal, says, Bar Yitzchak v'chosed, the son of Ovin, a giant of Torah, wisdom, wealth, and in the hidden secrets, who could expound on the 49 facets of each letter of the Torah. This is a grandfather, Shimon HaGadol, who was a contemporary of Rabbeinu Gershom. This is Rabbi Ovin HaGadol, who was descended from Yosef the Elder, the son of Rabbi Shimon of Mans. Mans is a city in central France, not far from Paris, who is the author of the Azhorah, Ata Hinchalta. The Azhorah were piyutim, were religious poems that contained much of the Taryag mitzvahs, 613 mitzvahs, which were said, the custom was to say them on Shavuos, on the giving of the Torah. This Shimon HaGadol was a descendant of this Rabbeinu Shimon of Mans. This was the inspiration of Rabbeinu Eliyahu the Elder, who we're going to see soon, who composed another Azhorah, another religious poem, Emes Yehegechiki. And to give you a sense of when this, because we don't have definitive dates, we just say he's the son of this one, he's the son of that one. When is Rabbeinu Shimon of Mans, when did he live to author this Ata Hinchalta? Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, who lived in the beginning of the 10th century, wrote his own Azhorah, his own very lengthy poem, which contained all the 613 mitzvahs, which is really a source of much scholarly commentary. In his preface to why he felt the need of authoring his own, he said, "I have found that the members of our generation say in the Musaf of Shavuos, the essentials of the Targum mitzvahs, which Hashem Yisborach, Hashem may be blessed, commanded the Jewish people in the form of compositions which begin with the words Atah Hinchalta." In other words, in the beginning of the 10th century, this was a widespread prayer, which was composed by a Jew who lived in the middle of France. So again, we don't have definitively when he lived. He must have lived much before Rav Sadia, that already had spread in his time, and he'd be must a person of great stature that it was well accepted. So again, just reading through the fragments, we have a sense of what Spanish or what the Jewry of France and Germany was during this very early time where we have so few records. Rabbeinu Shimon HaGadol, by the way, was a person who was known as a miracle worker. He was a correspondent with on paragraph C on page 9 of Meshulam Baruch Kalanimus. But he is also the source of a very interesting story. On page 10, there's a story which was published by Yehuda David Eisenstein in his Oitzer HaMedrashim. This is not a medrash per se, but it's a story. It's a story of Shimon HaGadol, who was descendant of the house of David. He came to the city of Mayence. And it could be he came originally from central France. He married a woman from one of the most prestigious families of the area. Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile, heard of his name and also came to Mayence to study under him. So evidently he was superior to Rabbeinu Gershom. And he goes on to explain this to explain the fact that Rabbeinu Gershom wrote many slichos. And the fact is, which is interesting, that Rabbeinu Gershom earlier in his life had lived in Spain. Even though Rabbeinu Gershom is understood as really was a person who came from that area of Germany, France. But he was a person who traveled to find the truth. And in this trip, he went to Mayence to study under Shimon HaGadol. On page, there's a very famous story of Shimon HaGadol, and this is part of this story quoted in this Oitzer Midrashim. Rabbeinu Shimon HaGadol had a small child named Elchanan. You could read the story in its details here, who was kidnapped from him. He was raised as a Catholic, became a priest, rose through the ranks, and eventually, according to the story, became Pope. There are a few versions of the story. The version that I quote here is that that after inquiries, this Elchanan found out who his true father was, summoned him, through the power of the church, summoned this Shimon HaGadol to him. Eventually, so you can read the story, eventually they became clear that it was a father and a son. The Elchanan, the son, wanted to repent, to do penance for lived a life that he had before that had abandoned in terms of his belief. And according to the story is, before a great crowd, he stood there and said that he no longer believes in the validity of Christianity. And he plunged himself from a tall building to his death, this Elchanan. And he did this to atone for the sin, and the Shimon HaGadol, who is also a poet, wrote one of his compositions was a Yotzer. There's the Yotzer is the poem which is said in the bracha of Yotzei Hamoreis, and as the first blessing of the Kriya Shema, and this is in it. There is a reference to Kael Hanun Chonon, in other words, El Chonon, to this, to his son. He is the author of this Rishimer Hagadol of many poems which are said on Yom Kippur, which is his Melech Elyon, you know. This is Ladi Yad Yimloich Melech Elyon, which we say in Yom Kippur is author of Shimon HaGadol, which is quoted here. There are other versions of this story. One version has it that the Pope issued a decree that forced the Jews to convert, and Shimon HaGadol is a leading figure in that area, came to the Pope, and they play chess together. And through the chair, remember, these were the moves that he had taught, Shimon HaGadol taught this Elchanan as a child. And through that game of chess, it was revealed there was a relation of a father and son. According to this version, somehow this Elchanan escaped and made his way back to his father and returned as a Jew. Again, there are many different versions. One is really hard to say what is the true story, what's the legend, you know. But as they say, you know, as the common saying is, but they don't say those kinds of stories about me or you. So it's quite possible there really is something to this. No, I mean, this from the research, not really. But again, it says if he just escaped or this, we know that history is, you know, has been rewritten. I mean, they said to Churchill, I think it was to Churchill. At the end of World War II, was asked how will history, you know, look upon him, and he said very favorably, because history is written by the victors. So it's hard to know, you know, from the church records what actually did occur. Again, another one of those stellar personalities during this period of time was Rebbe Eliyahu Hazoken, who wrote another Azhora. In other words, another poem containing at least the essential 613 mitzvahs. This is Emes Yagechiki. He also was a brother-in-law. This on page is 15. He happened to have been a brother-in-law of Rav Haigo. And this is on page 13. On paragraph B in the bold type in the middle of that paragraph. Rabbeinu Eliyahu evidently was influenced, was taught by Rabbeinu Gershom, but he was a brother-in-law of Rav Haigon. According here on page 13, this is the on the second on the, before B starts, the second paragraph, Rav Eliyahu the elder composed arrangements of verses of Torah, Novi, Ksuvim, to be said for each day of the 7 days of the week. He also composed Seder HaMarocha. This is the arrangement of all how the sacrifices were brought, which include all the parts of the service in the Beis HaMikdash and the related Torah portions. This is taken from the Sefer Eshkol, from the great Spanish authorities of the 12th century. Rabbeinu Eliyahu's Hazhoras are widely quoted in the subject of Tosfos in various areas quotes them, which is very interesting though. This is in the middle of page 14, paragraph E. He composed this Hazhora, in other words, this poem that's said on Shavuos, contained the 613 mitzvahs. It started off, again, with the letters of the Aleph Beis. He went from Aleph all the way to Tof. And then he went backwards from Tof all the way back to Aleph, you know, in the next section. And he concluded with the letters Aleph, Beis, Mem, Shin. And the Otzi Yisrael, also from Yehuda David Eisenstein, quotes that Ben Yaakov, a scholar, suggests it's a reference to the day of the composition, which was according to the Greek dating of documents, which was standard at that time, which 1,000, the Aleph would be 1,000, there's 342, the Shin Mem Beis. So, which equals to the year 1030 of the Common Era. So you get a sense of when he lived. We've discussed Shimon HaGadol, we discussed Rabbeinu's Eliyahu. These were people who lived in the Rhine Valley. There's Mayence. There was another very prominent area of Ashkenazic Jewry, and that was Provence, southern France. We touched upon before the Meshulam Ben Kolonimus was authored many responsa to Arles, Narbonne, communities in Provence. From Provence came again, this is right at the period before Rashi, at the end of the Gaonic period, produced Rav Moshe HaDarshan, which Rashi quotes quite often in Chumash, his brother, this is Rav Levi, and also Rav Yosef Tov Elam, his origin was from Provence, but he led the community of Limoges and Angers, which are in central France, northern France, not in southern France. But again, we signed the connection of all of France here. We have, and you could just read this yourself, as we have on page 15, about the origin. This is taken from an addendum to the Sefer Kabbalah, the origin of the Jewry in Provence. It seems that Charlemagne sent a message to the king of Bavel, the King Charles had connection to the king of Babylon. We know about that famous, again, the famous delegation that was sent in the year 801 to Baghdad. Now, probably this occurred then. The caliph was Harun ibn Rashid, and he wanted someone from the royal family of the Jews to be sent to his kingdom, I guess, to be a leader amongst Jews. Evidently, the Jewish community had grown to so greatly. He sent a person by the name of Rabbi Machir to the city, settled in Narbonne, which is a major city in Provence. And he goes on to explain what Rabbi Machir did and all his progeny, and it was from his family stayed there and became the leaders of Narbonne, leaders of a province. And it goes on again from this addendum, it's on page 16, a whole list of many, many great scholars that issued from this Babylonian scholar, Rabbi Machir. Rav Yosef Tov Elam, which we've discussed before, is widely quoted. You see all the quotes from Rashi, this is on the Talmud, and Tosfos. Not only was he a scholar that was quoted, he was also a scribe. He wrote a work which is a Tikkun Shtoros, in other words, what are the right ways to write documents, which is quoted by Tosfos in terms of how to write a get, a divorce document. But he also wrote over the responsa of the Gaonim. Major works of the Gaonim came from his pen. And they relied that his copying was most reliable. It was less apt to have errors because he was a great scholar in his own right. Again, he lived at the end of the period of the Gaonim. And as we quote here, he authored Response of the Gaonim on page 17, the Seder Tanoim Amroim, which we quoted in a previous lecture, which is a history which was created at the time of the Gaonim, was also a version which came from his pen. And again, he's always quoted because his version is seen to be the most authoritative. He's saying about Halachos Psukos. This is from a Yehudai Gaon. Again, he had a copy of that which he wrote over himself. There's Yetzras that are said, this is by us in the Kol that we say for Shabbos HaGadol, which go through the whole Seder. Those Yotzras are quoted. Tosfos and Psachim quotes them for halacha, and we say them even from those Yotzras that has become, at least part of it, became part of the Haggadah of Pesach, Chasal, Sidur Pesach, Kil Chasal. was authored by Rav Yosef Tuv Elam. You know, Kechol Meshpot, Kechol Kosol, everyone has their own Nigan. Another great authority, again this is towards the end of the Golnik area, is this, but just again to show, and as what a, you know, is that as the sun was setting in Babylon, the sun was rising in France and Germany, and ultimately we are descendants of those luminaries. Those were Moshe Hadarshan, which again Rashi quotes extensively on page 18. We quote just one of the many quotes of Rashi, you know, the Devorah, you know, this is Menekes, Devorah, the nurse of Rivka, died. And Rashi quotes from Chumash, quotes from Ben, this is a Moshe Darshan, what is this telling us? This is quoted here. Rashi and Tillim quotes him. In fact, in terms of to find the explanation of a word, Rabbeinu Gadol says the Yud Mahir does not mean fast, but in Arabic means an expert, and he was an expert on Arabic as well. He also was a Rosh Yeshiva. Not only was a scholar, says the city says, and the Orach, it seems, the author of Nosson, says, who was the author of the Orach, which we quoted before, that Rashi sought his advice, was a Talmud of this Rabbeinu Moshe Hadarshan. And he was called, says Rabbi Moshe, Rosh Yeshiva ben Morona Yaakov. This is how the Orach refers to him. And again, this Rabbeinu Moshe Hadarshan, it seems, came from a long line of scholars himself. Another contemporary here, who it seems lived in Italy, it's not clear, is Shlomo HaBavli, which is again quoted by Rashi in Chumash. He was a poet. He was the author, we have in the bottom of page 19, the Yotzer, so the first day of Pesach. And here he spells out his name, interestingly, Shlomo HaKotn Rabbi Yehuda, says Yechaya, says Yagdol, says Yigdol B'Torah U'Maisim Toivim Omein. He should live and he should grow in Torah and good deeds. Amen. And he spelled that out, you know, through his poetry. And he is, from the Slichos we have from him, and Rashi quotes him, really, from that poem that he has on Pesach, really to explain, which was, again, this week's Sedra, that the boards were used by, from the Mishkan, were planted by Yaakov Avinu. The source is the poetry of Shlomo HaBavli. Why he's called Shlomo HaBavli is not clear. I mean, he simply would be a Babylonian. Others want to say that the word Bavli is in medieval times was a reference to Rome. But whatever the case is, he was held the highest regard. He was a contemporary of this Shimon HaGadol, and Rabbeinu Gershom, and even the Beis Yosef, and there's Rabbi Yosef Karo in his response of Akas Rofo, also quotes him as an authoritative source. And again, I just wanted to show this is all of this is the kinds of people who lived during that time. And we generally tend to think, well, everything was in Bavel in the time of the Gaonim, then somehow Rashi just arose from Germany. But the truth is that there were great scholars during this whole period of time. And the last scholar I wanted to focus on is the most well-known of the pre-Rashi era, the end of the period of the Gaonim, is Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom, it seems from other sources, he traveled, he learned from many sources. The Marshal, in that response, wants to claim that he studied under Rav Haigoin as well. It's the only source we have, so I'm not sure. But one we know from a source closer to that time, that his Rebbe, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, who was a student of Rabbeinu Gershom, but in his younger years, had a question in Halacha. You can read this. And he sent his proofs, together with his colleague's proof, to Hagoin Rabbeinu Leontin, the master of Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile. And he was called Leontin, but his real name was Rabbi Yehuda ben Meir HaKoyen HaZaken. He was the Av Beis Din in his days. So here we find another person of great stature who actually had the greatest personal influence on Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom, in his time, was considered, though, the greatest authority. And Rashi has an interesting response, which we're going to touch upon this in a moment. There was a question of an excommunication that was issued by Rabbeinu Gershom, and then the question of annulling that excommunication. And Rashi says if it was something which was issued through the court of Rabbeinu Gershom, it can't be annulled because there's nobody who's of equal stature who's able to annul this. He says, we have no great man of his stature to annul the excommunication of Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile, from whose mouth we all live in the entire diaspora of Ashkenaz, which is German, and Kusim, which is a new name here, which includes, it seems, France, Rome, and Italy are the disciples of his disciples. So not only did we find before the Italian influence upon Germany, but now the reverse. Because of Rabbeinu Gershom, we find the French influence upon Italy. He is, to this day, he is very well known for his haramim, for the edicts of excommunication that he issued. And again, time doesn't allow us to go through all of them. One of the... On the bottom of page 20, we find they just have this. The first one is the prohibition. Says that one says to marry a second wife. So it says in the Shulchan Aruch, it says his takona, this legislation did not spread to all the lands. However, it says that the Ramah explains in all Ashkenazic lands it did take hold. There's also a question which is noted that he make it forever only to the end of the fifth millennium, like to the year 1240, which is another question. But this is a prominent place in Halacha, this excommunication. For that reason, Ashkenazic Jewry don't take a second wife, and only under very extreme circumstances that they have to have a heter me rabbonim, that they have to find 100 rabbis to sign, that there's under certain very narrow guidelines that there's an allowance, but it has to be approved by 100 rabbis. It says also, says that the on the top of page 21, Medina's Elishim Agarshim Bal Korcha Shalisha. You cannot divorce against a woman's will. Also, a cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. You can't, according to the Torah law, Talmudic law, divorce is something which the husband can initiate. According to Rabbeinu Gershom, you need the consent of the wife. We're not going to go through all of them, but you find it in italics here on number 7 here of this list. Chorem Shalavai Shabale Tshuva Ma'avoinim Lefonim. Says, he made an excommunication not to embarrass a Baal Tshuva, someone who repented for his previous sins, not to embarrass him. That response we quoted before in Rashi, that which Rabbeinu Gershom excommunicated cannot be annulled, refers to an instance that someone made bad, some terrible references to someone who under extreme circumstance had converted to Catholicism because during that period the church again and again tried to convert the Jews. Afterwards, when circumstances, that Jew went back to the fold and he was embarrassed, and the embarrasser was put into cherem. And it was told, that was the response, that he cannot get out of that excommunication because only someone of Rabbeinu Gershom's stature could annul that. He's not around. It's permanent. So just watch it. Also, another one which is quoted is Shlo liris b'ksav chaver. Don't read any other person's mail. Shlo b'shusho elim kem zaraka, only if he threw it out. Yeah. Any detectives in the audience, you don't have to worry. They only look through the garbage. Rabbeinu Gershon himself suffered because of these forced conversions on paragraph D. We have, says, the Rabbeinu Gershom Nisaba, this is brought down on this in Nagos Ashri. This is one of the commentators on this is on Moed, the Gemara Moed Kotten, chapter 3, says, Simen Nun Tes, in section 59. Rabbeinu Gershom sat in mourning for a period of 14 days when his son became an apostate. Because he died. The thing, he eventually died, but he sat 14 days because he made a Kal V'Chomer, just like by Miriam. Then he sat 14 days. His son became, it seems the story was he was forced to be an apostate, but nonetheless, even though he was forced to be apostate, he sat Shiva. And this is really the source of sitting Shiva when Rahman Litzlon, when the child goes off, the source is from this Rabbeinu Gershom. Yeah, well, we don't think, but that's his. I'm just saying, but this is from him. He was all, as was quoted before, Rabbeinu Gershom was an author of Slichos. We have here, this is a very famous, this part of it, it's at the end by Ne'ila, but it says, Zechor Bris Avraham by Kedis Yitzchak, V'hoshev Shvus Ola Yaakov V'hoshenu L'man Shemecha. Says Oir Hakodesh VaMachuzos VeLecherpo. Says Vizos. Says the holy city and its surroundings were subject of shame. V'chol Machmadel Tvois UGenuzos. All its precious, all the precious things contained were sunken and hidden. The Ein Shir says Rakaterazos. All that's left is this Torah. This is authored by Rabbeinu Gershom. In addition, of course, he authored works, it seems, over the whole Talmud. What's extant we have from him is on Bava Basra and Zvachim. But he, and of course his colleagues, the ones that we went over just now, this is Yosef Tuv Elam, this is Shimon HaGadol, this is Meshulam, planted the roots, the Seudos, the foundations, of what would become, says, what we know as Ashkenazic Jewry from Rashi and the Balei Tosfos, which Amir Hashem says in the coming years, we'll be discussing. In the next lecture, we will be discussing similarly the beginnings of Sephardic Jewry. That's in the next, 2 weeks, the next lecture. The author of that story was Rabbi Dr. Marcus Lehman. He had a very fertile imagination. I don't know what sources he himself used, if any, so I really can't say, but it's, as far as I know, it's a Maisa Bichl. So I don't know. This is going researching, you know, for this lecture. I haven't found any source about this.
Did GFP, for instance, the Charlemagne wanted somebody of stature, where there were Rabbeinu Gershom, again, tell me if this is not a real story, that he's something like about figuring out weights also?
Yeah, this is taken from that. There is such a story. I just recently read it, maybe present in a more reliable source. It had nothing to do with Charlemagne. This is a much later era, but it had to do with some local ruler about about weighing was a crown. This story again is brought in Lehman's work, so I'm not sure about the. The Jews who went these places, by and large, went there because these people were kind enough to take them in and offer them opportunities to do business. But socially, Jews, these were halachic Jews, and they kept to themselves socially. To the extent that they had to do business with Parnosa, they had to do with the local non-Jewish population. But it extended just in terms to the sphere of business, but socially they really kept to themselves.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.